pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views, and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business, and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, listeners. We're up to episode 24, can you believe it, of the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. And, of course, with me once again is the Velvet Glove himself. Scott, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Trevor. How about yourself?
Going well. I had an afternoon nap.
You had an afternoon nap?
I did. Feel very, look at that, on a Wednesday, an afternoon nap.
Well, bloody hell.
Must be getting close to Christmas.
Yeah, it must be.
I'm winding down. So don't tell my boss. So, Scott, we've got a few things on the agenda. And one of the ones that we're going to lead off with is, once again, in the United States of America, they had another gun massacre, this time in San Bernardino, where this couple went on a rampage. And it seems that it would be very difficult for ordinary people to spot them as radicalized Muslims, but that's what they seem to have turned out to be. But anyway, the interesting thing, I think, is in a God-fearing country like America, we're starting to get some anti-religious headlines.
Yes.
So yes. The New York Daily News, and I think their sister paper, maybe it was the Washington version or something like that, had the headline of "God isn't fixing this," and the subheadings to go with it were: as the latest batch of innocent Americans are left lying in pools of blood, cowards who could truly end gun scourge continue to hide behind meaningless platitudes. And this, of course, is all a reference to this, you know, our thoughts and prayers are with the victims. So finally, mainstream media in America is saying this thoughts and prayers stuff ain't good enough, it's not fixing it, and we've got a headline paper, which I think is great.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it really is. It's fine and good and that sort of stuff to say our thoughts and prayers. But the reality is the thoughts and prayers aren't getting anywhere. You know, if you go into it, it's it's clear from the claim being made here, one edge, Democrats care about doing something, taking action, while Republicans waste time offering meaningless prayers. And you know what? I've got to agree with them. It's, you know, it's a crazy bloody thing that you sit there and say, oh, well, you know, I'll just pray for them. Well,
yes,
prayers hasn't worked out with all the other times. Why the hell would they think it would work out now?
To the same God that just allowed it to take place in the
first place. Well, that's precisely it, yes. You know?
Yes. So, but you know what you can always count on in America, of course, is the Fox News. To shock and dismay, and one of the programs titled Fox and Friends, one of their contributors, Robert Jeffress, discussed the issue. This article describes Jeffress as an obnoxious Christian extremist and host of Pathway to Victory. But anyway, what he said during the thing on Fox News was, look, prayer's not some meaningless activity we engage in to make ourselves feel better. When we pray, we're talking to somebody greater than ourselves and asking him to do some specific things, to heal those who are wounded, to give grace to those who've lost loved ones, to protect our law enforcement personnel. Prayer's always the right thing we should do. It's the first thing we should do, but it's not the only thing we should do. And in this article it says, Jeffress is wrong. Prayer is not a dialogue. It is a monologue. There's nobody greater than ourselves listening. I love that line. It's not a dialogue, it's a monologue. That is really, really good. And I think one of the other hosts there... have I got a quote where she was basically, you know, if you're against prayer, then you're lining up with terrorists. That's right. Yes. Elizabeth Hasselbeck said, I say this, if you want to line up with terrorists and try to take God away, you're not on the right side. That's all I'd have to say to those politicians who want to tell you to stop praying.
But I mean, you know, it then goes down further. Currently, Hasselbeck was unaware that almost always the terrorists are not trying to take God away. On the contrary, almost always terrorists believe they're acting on behalf of their own God.
Yes.
You know, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah. So while we might think things are bad here at times, we can look across there, the Pacific, and lo and behold, craziness abounds. So, that's refreshing, though, to finally see some mainstream media calling out religion. So,
absolutely, you know, it really is well and truly overdue. But still, in all, it's started.
Yes, and so the other interesting thing in relation to that is what would you expect the Dalai Lama to say in response to something like that?
Well, I mean, I would assume that the Dalai Lama, you know, because he's often he's said an awful lot of sensible stuff before. I would assume he'd say something along the lines that there's no point praying because you're praying to the person that created the situation.
Yeah, so the Dalai Lama, he's on the record. He's saying that we cannot solve this problem only through prayers. I'm a Buddhist and I believe in praying, but humans have created this problem and now we are asking God to solve it. It is illogical. Says the Dalai Lama. God would say, solve it yourself because you created it in the first place. You know, there's a few things wrong in all of that, but anyway, it was interesting that just the Dalai Lama would say, forget about prayer, it's not going to help.
Well, exactly. You know, it's, yeah.
So, previously, Scott, the 12th man provided us with some sort of a secular version of the Ten Commandments.
Yes.
And I stumbled across another version of that. And it was a bit of a resolution to try and have a few more positive things rather than ranting about anti-religion all the time. So this is an article that we've linked to where they had a competition calling for an atheist version of the Ten Commandments. And they offered $10,000 awarded to 10 winners. And the contest drew 2,800 submissions from 18 countries and 27 US states. And I quite the Ten Commandments that these guys came up with. So I'm guessing everyone who got a commandment in got $1,000. So, Scott, number one, be open-minded and be willing to alter your beliefs with new evidence. Good.
Number two, strive to understand what is the most likely to be true, not to believe what you wish to be true.
Very good. Three, the scientific method is the most reliable way of understanding the natural world.
Number four, every person has the right to control their body.
Five was, God is not necessary to be a good person or to live a full and meaningful life.
Number six, be mindful of the consequences of all your actions and recognize that you must take responsibility for them.
Seven, treat others as you would want them to treat you and can reasonably expect them to want to be treated. Think about their perspective. Actually, I like the little qualification on there. Treat others as you would want them to treat you and can reasonably expect them to want to be treated. So a bit of reasonableness comes in there because some people might have some unreasonable expectations of how they want to be treated.
Oh, well, that's it. That's exactly right.
Yeah, so yeah. I like the way that one was given a bit of a qualification.
Number eight, we have the responsibility to consider others, including future generations.
Yes. Nine, there is no one right way to live.
And lucky last 10, leave the world a better place than you found it.
So, all good ideas, and there we go. They've come up without reference to a holy book, and it probably was a great help rather than a hindrance. They weren't confused and having to refer to one, and they could just head off with what they thought was right.
Well, exactly.
So there's a bunch of different atheist, secular, humanist Ten Commandments littered around the internet, and that's not a bad version.
Agreed.
Now, I wanted to slip this one in. Did you see Malcolm Turnbull's innovation statement?
I did see the. I did see some of the press regarding that. Yeah.
Mm, what'd you think?
Look, I could well be exposing myself here, but look, I think that it was probably a good move. The argument being that this is going to lead to greater prosperity because it'll lead to more innovation and so on and so forth. Anyway, yeah, that's all in all, I thought it was a good move.
I'm not so sure. Surprise, surprise. I watched him on the 7:30 report with Lee Sales. Did you see that at all?
Yeah. I did see that, okay, yeah.
Because he'd previously been on the 7:30 report and she was accused of sort of fawning over him. And,
yeah.
And this time, you know, people said she was trying to be tougher. And I didn't see that at all. The thing that got me out of it was that finally we have a Prime Minister with some charm. Like, we want to agree with him or not about policies or whatever, but at least he could say stuff with a wry smile and a bit of charm and a bit of humour and rather than what we've had to put up with in terms of Abbott and Rudd and Gillard and, it was almost a bit Keating-like in his confidence with the subject and wanting to sort of deliver it in an interesting fashion and happy to sit there and charm the interviewer a little bit and have a bit of fun. That was the thing that I really liked out of it. But I was been thinking about it because what they're doing with this innovation statement is they're saying that if you invest money in a startup that is a sort of an innovation type startup, then you get a 20% rebate. So effectively it's lowering the tax rate for investing in a certain sector. And remember we did I'm gonna have to put a link in the show notes. Remember we did that podcast once and we talked about the different rates of tax on different income?
Yes.
Yeah. So there are all these different categories or ways of earning income and they all had different income tax rates. And it just seemed ludicrous that you could have two people, you could have 10 different people, all of them earning $100,000 in various different ways and all paying a different rate of tax. And at the time I thought, well, that doesn't make sense. You effectively, if you're earning 100, all these 10 people should pay the same amount of tax. So,
yeah.
So to me, this just creates another category of people who are getting a different tax rate. And the other thing about it is IT, they're notorious for shifting their income overseas, and it doesn't matter how attractive we make the tax rate here, they've got a really bad track record in the IT sector for intellectual property sector for shifting income overseas, and we don't get to tax it as we should. So I just worry that we could, create businesses by this, and ultimately those businesses we won't receive a tax benefit from anyway because of their notorious ability to sort of easily shift their income overseas rather than, traditional industries within Australia of, food production or mining or whatever. It's a lot harder for them to artificially shift income overseas. So, I think encourage kids at school level and high school level to become aware of innovation options. And if they like the area, they'll go into it, like whether there's a 20% tax break or not, I think, myself. There you go.
I understand what you're saying, but by the same token, if you do nothing, which is what we have been doing for a very long time in the area, then you will always get what you've already got.
Yes.
So I am sympathetic to what you've just said.
Yeah.
I'm not, what's the word I'm groping for? I'm not I'm not convinced that there'll be a problem.
See, I agree we should do something, but I would see it more at the high school and university level of making things more... Well, for a start, we just don't have teachers now capable of teaching high-level maths. It's extremely difficult to find teachers who can do that. So we need to pay teachers more so that high-level maths people will become teachers or stay in teaching. And then, you know, other things that could be done at the university level as well, I think. So, yes, do something there, I would say. But, what did we say in these Ten Commandments? Let me just find them. That be open to other ideas. So I think it was number one. Yes, be open-minded and willing to alter your beliefs. Like, I am willing to alter my belief and be open-minded, but I'm just very suspicious of creating another specially taxed sector.
Well, I mean, you can always look at it this way. If you do create the, if you're doing that, creating a whole industry that's based around tax avoidance, then there'll be a new industry for us to tax.
That's right. We might. So, our specialty might be tax avoidance. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, a bit like border protection.
Yeah, precisely.
So, anyway, that was Malcolm Turnbull, innovation statement. We'll see what happens there. And. Just prior to starting the podcast, I was watching the news, and I think we've avoided talking about Donald Trump so far, haven't we?
Oh, God, yes, we have. Yeah. But, I mean, unfortunately, I think we're going to have to say something.
Yes.
So, Donald Trump has... I'll take the lead on this. He has firmly placed his foot in his mouth... and has come out and said that they should not be allowing any Muslims into the country.
That's right.
You know, the man is mad, but anyway, yeah, he's a lunatic. And on top of all that... I've lost what I was going to say. Yeah,
all right, go on. That's okay. So, yes, he's called for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. And what he said was... but fortunately, Scott, he later clarified his statement.
Oh, he has clarified, has he?
Yeah, right. His clarification was that the ban would include American citizens returning from overseas travel.
Okay, so if you're an American citizen and you're not a citizen of another country, then you're stuck.
That's right. So if you're a Muslim American on holidays at the moment, get back before Donald is made president, because you may not get back in. And the other thing you'll be pleased to know he clarified was that Muslims serving in the US military would be allowed to return, but we have to be vigilant. So if you're a Muslim serving in the US military, you'll be allowed back in, but I'll be watching you very, very heavily.
See, the man is mad, isn't he?
Yes. And, you know, the amazing thing is that, of course, the Democrats and most Americans are going, this is just awful, crazy nonsense. What an embarrassment this is. They're saying he should be disqualified from even running for president. Yet the fellow Republican nominees are saying things along the lines of, well, you know, I don't want to criticise Donald Trump, don't want to comment, and, you know, if he became president, I would support him. You know, these sorts of comments, so...
Yeah, and it's just that they're just... the guys that are left behind that are actually saying that sort of stuff, they're having to say that because, you know, well, he's the front runner in the Republican pack right now, but, you know, I would assume that after that sort of nonsense that he'll fall back, I would have thought.
Yeah, what he'll do is he will end up resigning from the Republican Party, I'm sure. That was always going to happen one way or another, because he's just so much of a maverick and not a team player. And then he'll run as some sort of independent, which will split the Republican vote horrendously, and he'll just end up causing major mischief for the Republican Party more than he has already, and it'll be a shoo-in for the Democrats to waltz into power again.
Yeah.
So... you know, I can remember saying in an earlier podcast when on Q&A they were talking about what does the world think of Australia? Five prime ministers in 6 years or something. What an embarrassment. You know, what does the world think of us? And I was responding by saying, well, hang on a minute. We can just look at the Republican nominees in America and say, we're not too impressed, and that's a far more dangerous thing than the number of prime ministers mm-hmm. we've had. And it really is. Like, people talk about our defence treaties and things. If any of these nutters get in charge, you can throw common sense out the window.
So, well, certainly you can, yeah. Mm. It's madness.
Mm. So, still on Islam, and there's lots of calls for Islam to sort of undergo a reformation now, and our former leader Tony Abbott was just only recently saying something along those lines. Have you heard those comments, Scott?
I haven't actually heard those, no.
So he's been making comments about Islam needing to undergo a reformation, and he's really enjoying the troublemaking role out there. Like, the sort of things he was saying, I was actually, you know, not disagreeing with entirely, but he's just loving, almost playing a Kevin Rudd type role in trying to destabilise the person who knifed him.
Yeah.
And he said when he, I'm pretty sure he said when he got rolled that he wouldn't be interfering and sniping from the background, but I don't think he's done anything else but that, so...
And that's precisely what he said he would be doing, but of course he's... Exactly.
Another broken promise. Mm. So there's a group called the Muslim Reform Movement, and linked to an article, and they're basically saying that we are moderate Muslims and we are seeking to reform Islam, and they list a number of ideals, and they're saying, you know, come and join our movement, sign up, you know, sort of on change.org and other things to sort of... So a little movement starting up, trying to do that sort of thing, which is incredibly difficult to do. Some of their ideals, though, I will read. They said that every individual has the right to publicly express criticism of Islam. Ideas do not have rights. Human beings have rights. We reject blasphemy laws. They are a cover for the restriction of freedom of speech and religion. They also say we believe in freedom of religion and the right of all people to express and practice their faith or non-faith without threat of intimidation, persecution, discrimination or violence. Apostasy is not a crime. So this particular group is saying fantastic stuff about what they think Islam is. I don't think they're correct, but if it's a statement of what Islam should be, fantastic. How you go about changing it is, I don't know how they're going to do it. I mean, they keep talking about, you know, the majority of Muslims are peaceful people, and that is true. Especially, well, that's true in Western countries, but it's not necessarily true in some other countries. And I'll put a link to an article. I didn't tell you about this one, Scott, but it was written by a guy, David French. And he's basically provided some of the statistics where polls have been taken of Muslim people in various countries around the world. And, you know, death penalty for leaving Islam, and looking at the responses in countries. And somewhere like Egypt, 86% of people think there should be the death penalty for leaving Islam, you know.
You're joking.
Afghanistan, 79%. Pakistan, 76%. You know, huge percentage of ordinary people in these countries think there should be a death penalty for moving away from Islam. You know, is even whether they have a negative view of ISIS. So in Pakistan, 71% of people either said they liked ISIS or they didn't know whether they objected to ISIS. Only 25%. Is that 26% objected to ISIS? So a huge number just could not say something negative about ISIS. So some of these countries, the majority of the population have got some pretty, pretty tough views on the rest of us in terms of blasphemy and killings and things like that. So,
well, it's amazing that you've got that number of people actually saying that they would support the death penalty for leaving the religion.
Well, you've got to remember that in these countries, the mainstream media is full of anti-Semitic propaganda and anti-West propaganda and pro, like, hardline right-wing Islam. So it's, you know, there's a huge amount of indoctrination that has to be overcome in a number of these countries. So so it's all very well for, you know, some right-minded Muslims in Western countries to start up groups for the reform of Islam. It's just going to be really difficult to pull that off in some of the less civilized parts of the world. I don't know how they're going to do it.
Well, I mean, you know, I suppose we should just get behind them and say, well, you know,
yes,
go for it, guys.
Yep.
You know, but you're right, it's going to be very difficult for them to do that. But yeah, my hat's off to them. I mean, I read the whole thing and was very impressed with everything I read in there.
Yeah. Actually, let me read this other thing from this article. He was saying, in 2014, the Anti-Defamation League released the results of polling 53,100 people in 102 countries for evidence of anti-Semitic attitudes and belief. The numbers from the majority Muslim world are difficult to believe for those steeped in politically correct rhetoric about Islam. A full 74% of North African and Middle Eastern residents registered anti-Semitic beliefs, including 92% of Iraqis, a whopping 69% of the relatively circular Turks, and 74% of Saudis. So, huge numbers of people, very anti-Semitic beliefs. And that continued even when the Muslim nations are far removed from the Arab-Israeli conflict. So, in Malaysia, 61% had anti-Semitic attitudes, which is a majority Muslim country. But in neighbouring Thailand, which is a majority Buddhist, only 13%. So it was definitely related to religion. And so nasty stuff. So when people say that the majority of the Muslim world is peace-loving, majority of Western Muslims would be, but I don't know so much about the entire world.
Well, we'll have to see, but you know, those what's just been released by that was the Pew Research.
That particular one was Anti Defamation League results of polling. So, don't know if that involved Pew Research or not, but got a link here. The Rationalist Society provide some extracts from a little running commentary in the letters page, which I think was The Age. It might have been the Sydney Morning Herald, but I think it was The Age. And there's a fellow, Ian Robinson, in his letter to the editor said, "Peoples of faith make this unfounded claim to knowledge..." Let me just rewind here. So, Ian Robinson is the president of the president emeritus of the Rationalist Society. So he had obviously written something in the paper, and a fellow called Rowan Forster wrote in to complain about what Ian Robinson said. So his letter said, "Ian Robinson says people of faith make this unfounded claim to knowledge they do not possess. This typifies a condescending arrogance among some atheists who lay claim to superior knowledge. Is Mr. Robinson seriously telling the many millions of Christians worldwide that their transforming and sustaining faith in Christ is delusional? that heroes of the faith such as Wilberforce, Schweitzer, King, Tutu, Romero and countless others were inspired by a proven falsehood. A similar demeaning disparagement is shown by those who equate faith in God to an infantile belief in a tooth fairy or Easter bunny. The difference could not be more stark. So that's Rowan Forster complaining about what Ian Robinson had said. And then Ian Robinson replied in another letter to the editor 2 days later. So this is the response by Ian Robinson about Rowan Forster. He says, Rowan Forster asks if I am seriously telling the many millions of Christians worldwide that their faith in Christ is delusional. Well, yes. After carefully studying the evidence, I am. And I am joined in this by the many millions of Jews, Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists, etc. worldwide who share my doubts about Jesus' divinity. On the other hand, Forster's many millions of Christians worldwide are telling all the Jews, Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists, etc. that their views are delusional. Everyone is an atheist except about their own delusion. Good on you, Ian Robinson. Good to see a discussion like that in the letters page, Scott.
Absolutely. You know, it is. It's high time that we opened it up, and so congratulations.
So, Rowan Forster was just could not believe that someone would make such a statement. Australian schools. Well, we talk about education a lot, and
that's an important issue.
It is. It really is, and I think I've mentioned in the past that. We've got some structural problems in our school system, and linked to an article basically making the point that Australia now has one of the more unequal education systems in the world. So they do studies, and there's one that there's a link to here, show that the proportion of kids who go to socially mixed or average schools is lower in Australia than in most other comparable countries. So we're creating haves and have-nots in the education system, which is way out of whack with what's going on in other countries. So here we go. Looking overseas can provide insight about possible solutions. Australia and Canada have similar demographics, economies and levels of income, inequality and poverty. But schools are much more socially integrated there than here. Not surprisingly, while privileged students perform the same in both countries, disadvantaged students and schools in Australia perform substantially worse on international achievement tests. So it goes on to say that... the top kids in both systems do quite well, but the bottom kids in Australia are really suffering because they're in schools that are just not getting the resources and funding, and the kids are not mixed. So we're creating haves and have-nots, which I think is really dangerous for our future, Scott.
No, look, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I mean, it is surprising to me now that I'm, you know, outside of the system, but when I was in school, I just assumed that everyone else's school was the same. It's not, though. You know, it is really surprising.
What school did you go to?
I went to Toowoomba Grammar.
Right, okay.
So. Yeah, so I was, you know, what they would call the elite school for boys.
Yeah. So, secular party policy, follow the Gonski report, and that is all about providing more money to schools that need it because of the requirements of the students, either socioeconomic or disability or Aboriginal or whatever. So there's a lot of, you know, Gonski would address a lot of those issues. And I'm still waiting to hear from Malcolm Turnbull. Like, as we mentioned before, he's a personal friend of Gonski. So it'd be really nice if he, you know, took on the Gonski recommendations as a result of that.
Well, one would hope he does.
Pope Francis.
Yes.
You know, he comes out with stuff all the time. The point's still to be made. Catholic Church doesn't do anything about contraception. It's still...
No, it's madness.
1968, they banned contraception.
Yeah.
Pope Paul VI. And they just refused to change it. So, yeah. Apparently, well, I don't know if you read this part. Did you see how many people per year? The annual abortion rate for the world?
40 million, wasn't
40
it?
40 million abortions per year in the world.
Yeah.
What an amazing number.
Yeah.
And,
an incredible number, too.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of, the Catholic Church has a lot to answer for in that regard, because they just refuse to address, contraception. So, another article there complaining about the Pope and when will he actually do something like that that would make a change. Don't hold your breath, Scott. Well,
no, I'm not holding my breath, but I just find it incredible that in 1968 that you know, what are we now, more than 40 years on, we're still talking about something that happened that long ago. It's madness. Mm. It really is madness. Mm.
I was sitting on a plane yesterday with a guy who was, I couldn't help but sneak a look on his phone as he was, well, he was praying. He was Greek Orthodox.
Yeah.
And so he, guess what? We struck up a conversation about religion. Can you believe it?
No, I can't believe that. Yeah, but anyway.
So I was, because my knowledge of Greek Orthodox was pretty ordinary and... So, you know, Old Testament, New Testament, and we're very much in line, all of Christianity, and then it diverged. And the sort of Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox have maintained a very similar service and beliefs, whereas the other branch of the Catholics, well, they left... They broke away from the Catholics when the Pope, I think in around 1000 AD, decided he was in charge and was infallible and he was the head honcho, and the Greek Orthodox broke away from the Catholic Church at that point because they weren't happy with that. So they're more a collegiate type group who have different bishops type people who make decisions, but that still has to be approved by the congregation. So... That was good.
Right, okay.
But in relation to contraception, they are okay with condoms, and, but they have a problem then when it comes to abortion. So they see that as sort of killing of a life. But at least, so, you know, someone like the Greek Orthodox would say there's nothing wrong with condoms. And if only the Catholic Church could take that on board, what a difference that would make around the world.
Oh, yeah, it would.
Meanwhile, millions really continue to suffer. But anyway, the other thing that often crops up, which is one of the things that gets me, Scott, is, and we've done it a little bit with the Ten Commandments, is, you know, if we didn't have religion, then the civilization would just fall into rack and ruin.
Oh,
we'd be,
no.
We'd be running around killing and raping each other. And we would just... Does that... I gather that annoys you as well?
Yeah, it does. It's really... Yeah. Where would you like to go to? Because we've got three of them here.
Yeah, I like the one about violence. So there's one here titled, Think Religion Makes Society Less Violent?
Society Less Violent.
Think Again. And basically it says, the theory is simple. If people become less religious... then society will decay, crime will skyrocket, violence will rise, and once civilized life will degenerate into immorality and depravity. I mean, that's
just nonsense.
That is a very common statement, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I like the line afterward. Yeah. It's an old and widespread notion, and it's demonstrably false.
Yes.
You know, it's true. It's clearly false.
Yeah. So what this piece does is examine religiosity and violence in different communities to see if there's some sort of correlation or connection between the two. So what it says is, if it were true that when belief in God weakens, the society's well-being diminishes, and we should see abundant evidence for this. But we don't. In fact, we find just the opposite. Those societies today that are the most religious, where faith in God is strong and religious participation is high, guess what? Tend to have the highest violent crime rates. While those societies in which faith and church attendance are the weakest, i.e. the most secular societies, tend to have the lowest. So, at an international level, secular societies, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Czech Republic, Estonia, Japan, Britain, France, Netherlands, Germany, South Korea, New Zealand, Australia, Vietnam, Hungary, China, Belgium, whereas most religious, Nigeria, Uganda, Philippines, Pakistan, Morocco, Egypt, Zimbabwe, Bangladesh, El Salvador, Colombia, Senegal, Malawi, and various studies showing that, you know, the 10 nations with the highest homicide rates are all very religious. And on the flip side, each of the 10 safest and most peaceful nations in the world is the most secular.
Yeah.
So, and then the interesting one as well is, you know, there's sort of socioeconomic things come into this, which, you know, poor countries, you might expect more violence or other factors. But one I found interesting was, even within the United States of America, if you take the 10 states that are the most religious and the 10 states that are the least religious, you'll find that the religious states are the most violent and the non-religious states are the least violent within the same country.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? It really is amazing. And even down here, consider child abuse fatality rates. Highly religious Mississippi is twice that of highly secular New Hampshire's, and highly religious Kentucky's is four times that of highly secular Oregon's. You know, it's amazing.
It is amazing. So I've got to keep remembering to quote that sort of thing when people sort of trot out this, well, without religion, where would we be? You know, we'd be disintegrating into a civilization out of a Mad Max movie sort of thing. And
that's the thing that I find incredibly annoying about that, is that they've got this argument that you'd end up being a dystopian society, but it's just not the case.
Yes, I like the line that the 12th man came up with, where his friends said that people would say, well, you know, without religion, you know, you'd go around and you'd rape and pillage as much as you want to. And his friend said, well, I already do. And meaning, of course, he doesn't want to rape and pillage at all.
Exactly.
So, right thinking people don't. You don't need a book, folks, to tell you that. So, anyway, that's a good one to trot out, I reckon, when people talk about, you know, well, if you get rid of religion, where would we be then? Well, the answer is nicely trotting along.
Yeah, I mean, not only that, it then goes further, and there's another study. Study finds that children raised without religion show more empathy and kindness.
Yes.
This is a study that was conducted by the University of Chicago, found that children raised in non-religious households are kinder and more altruistic than those raised with religion.
Yes.
You know, so
they were more willing to share.
Exactly. Hmm. Yeah.
Did you read how they did that study?
I did.
Because you sort of kind of wonder, well, how do they work that out? But what they did was, they sent this stuff out around the world to these different people who had to self-assess how religious they were. So I guess there were questions about their attendance and the observance of religion, and then the parents were given some stickers for their children, and a little game was played with the children, and the children were then told that the game was interrupted, that there wasn't time to finish the game, and of the 10 stickers that they had, they could, you know, keep them for themselves, or they could give some to their friend or whatever it was. And Yeah. They then could count how many stickers a kid was prepared to give away at that point. And that was the measure of generosity of a kid. I thought that was just an interesting interesting way of collecting data.
Well, exactly.
I think a few people have poo-pooed that method because I've seen subsequent things. But anyway, these are the sorts of things that psychologists do to try and get this sort of data. Self-assess yourself on religiosity and then stick a thing, a little test on the kids as to how many they were prepared to give away at that point. So, I just thought that aspect was interesting.
Absolutely.
Now, Andrew's government in Victoria got through some same-sex adoption changes, but unfortunately, I think the Christian lobby was successful in getting an exemption for religious groups involved in adoption. They tried hard, the Andrews government, so full marks to them always, but unfortunately couldn't get it over the line with the support they needed in the upper house. So so that was the result there. And there was an interesting thing in relation to penalty rates, Scott.
Yeah.
See that one?
I did see that one,
I've got a great deal of sympathy for people who have to work on the weekends, because I reckon it would suck. Well, I used, you know, when you're a student and you're young, you work on weekends, and it would, you know, it didn't worry me that much then, but I know now it would really annoy me that at different times if you've got to work on weekends, and people should be paid more for doing it, I reckon. And in this article, there was a lobby group from the restaurant and catering industry. Thought it would be a good idea to write to the Labor backbencher, Kelvin Thompson, and they're angling to have Sunday rates cut and arguing that doing so would generate jobs. And so his response was to wait until a Sunday and then phone the Restaurant and Catering Industry Association to talk about the matter. And guess what, Scott? No one was working on Sunday. So the lobby group was more than happy for workers to be working on Sundays at normal rates, yet they weren't manning the phones themselves on Sundays.
No, of course not. Yeah, and it was it was ridiculous. No, it wasn't a ridiculous thing for him to do. It was the right thing to do, but it showed the stupidity of the lobby group.
Good little stunt for him to get some publicity. I quite like that method. So, I don't know, Scott. Like they talk about how this would increase the economy by, you know, making it easier for people to trade on weekends. And I just think, take Sunday for example, like, surely if you want to buy something, if you can't buy it Monday through to Saturday, like, you can only, does it really add that much to the economy?
Well, this is the thing that I don't understand, is would it really add that much to the economy? I personally think that what we ought to do, you know, if you want to get into a discussion about this, I personally think that what we ought to do is do away with Sunday trading and then have another, say, Tuesday and Thursday night, late night trading.
Yes.
And then have some Saturday trading going through until 6 or something like that, maybe starting at 8 and finishing at 6. Yep. And, you know, just then kill off Sunday trading.
Yeah.
Because I fail to see that it's going to achieve, that it achieves anything at all.
Yeah, it just means people spread out their buying over 7 days that they could do in 6 if they had to. And
if they had to, they'd get it done in their 6 days. Yeah.
So, you know, as a matter of a society that's functioning and people are happy, you know, it's important to have one day off a week where people can do things as families and stuff like that.
Well, look, that's exactly it. And, you know, I mean, it's to my way of thinking, if you had Sunday as being the day that you, that if you went into, well, I mean, our meetings are always on a Sunday at the library,
you know,
and then so if you went and had a coffee afterwards, then you just got to pay a, you know, instead of paying $3.50, you pay $3.85. You know, it's something I'd be more than happy to have on a Sunday to pay a higher amount.
I agree.
You know, I think that would be a preferable situation.
Yep. And you end up with these groups, you know, who have we got here? The Restaurant and Catering Industry Association. You know, a lot of these groups are dominated by big business and, you know, they don't have the community interest at heart. They're just about money for big players normally, so I wouldn't trust them. They'd be pushing out the smaller guys and looking after the bigger guys. So, full marks to Kelvin Thompson for ringing them up on a Sunday and noting that nobody was at home.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah. No, that's a good stunt.
Scott, got any others that you wanted to run through at all?
It's the 10 years since the Cronulla riots this week.
Right.
This is something that the 12th Man actually sent out, actually, a couple of days back. He sent over an ABC article saying far-right groups preaching anti-Islam nationalism 10 years after the Cronulla riots. Mm. This week marks the 10 years since the simmering turf war in Sydney's Sutherland Shire exploded into a violent brawl that became known as the Cronulla riots. It's surprising it was 10 years, actually. But anyway, I don't have a lot to say about it other than it's been 10 years. I don't think it's a... You know, reading the article, you're left with the impression that it was a horrible, horrible thing that, you know, we really ought to be ashamed of and that sort of stuff. But... You know, yes, it was wrong and so on and so forth, but I don't think it's something that you really should have the whole country feeling ashamed of.
No.
Would be my position. Yeah,
I feel quite divorced from it being in Brisbane at the time.
Yeah.
But I did see there that some of the people who were involved in it and were charged and their faces exposed on the media are very, very embarrassed and shamed by what they did, which is interesting. Hmm.
Yeah, no doubt. And but you know, it was at a time, you know, I think most of the people that were involved in it were below 30 anyway.
Yeah.
So it was probably a fairly juvenile thing that a lot of guys got involved in.
But, just goes to show though, civilized country Australia can degenerate into a riot in pretty short order.
Well, it can do, yes.
Like, you wouldn't have thought so. If I said to you today, if you know, if you weren't aware of that incident, oh, you know, in 2 weeks' time there could be a major riot in Cronulla where gangs of people are attacking each other and doing serious harm and marauding around the street looking for people who look like foreigners, you just wouldn't believe it, would you?
No, you wouldn't believe it.
But it did actually happen, so it just goes to show that it doesn't... You're not that far from just what Lord of the Flies type situation erupts very quickly if you're not
well
careful.
It can do, yes. Yeah for sure.
So Scott, that's probably going to do me, I reckon. I'm tempted next week. I'll do it, I promise. Now I okay. Listened to something and I've about Syria, and I'm going to explain Syria in 5 minutes next week.
Is that right? Okay.
So everything you need to know about the players in Syria in 5 minutes. I'll be talking quickly, but I'll give it a go then. So but I think I'll leave
no
that
worries.
Well,
we'll put that we'll put that on the first item for next week then, shall
we'll
we?
Do that. Very good.
No problem at all.
Alrighty, Scott. I'm going to head off. You're going
to
head off.
Nice to talk to you. And we'll talk again next
okay.
week.
Bye, everyone.
See you then. Bye now.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf, on their phone, and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.